Hi, everybody. Good evening, and welcome to another exciting Lyrically Speaking event presented by the Aspen Writers Foundation and Jet Ride. We are broadcasting live tonight. I'd like to welcome our Aspen Public Radio listeners. Thank you all for joining us. A huge thank you to our wonderful sponsors and friends, Jet Ride, the Sky Hotel, Issa and Daniel Shaw, the Molly Gibson Lodge, D&E Ski and Snowboard Shop, Plum TV, the Aspen Skiing Company, Anthony Solier, Iberian Rugs, KSPN, the St. Regis Aspen, Snow Queen Vodka, Jan and Django Crosby, Words, Pictures, Colors, Aspen Public Radio, and of course, the Belly Up. Please note that tonight's artist's charity of choice is Doctors Without Borders, an independent international medical humanitarian organization that delivers emergency aid to people affected by armed conflict, epidemics, natural or man-made disasters, or exclusion from healthcare in nearly 60 countries. A portion of tonight's proceeds will go to Doctors Without Borders, and if you would like to make a donation, the website is www.doctorswithoutborders.org. So I want to tell you quickly, most of you have been here before for a Lyrically Speaking event, and if you haven't, this is a conversation infused with a concert. There will be a question and answer for a session at the end. And there are, many of you have seen little index cards with pencils. Please write down your question. If you have one, hold it up. We will grab it, and we will give it to our interviewer tonight to ask, because we do want it to be available for our public viewing, listening audience. And I can tell you this, that when I asked Mr. Crosby how he felt about questions and answers, he said, "It's my favorite part, and no subject is off limits." So, I'm going to hand this over to our interviewer, who is a good friend of ours, a wonderful advisor, Paul Zolo. He's a senior editor at American Songwriter magazine, an author, photographer, songwriter, and music journalist, and he's an incredible gentleman. His best known work is Songwriters on Songwriting, a collection of 62 interviews with the world's greatest songwriters. And we do have that book, as well as Since Then, by David Crosby, in the front, right here in the lobby. Town Center Booksellers is here selling books. I highly encourage you to buy them. And then the other thing, I just wanted to share one quick story. We were listening to the sound check today. I'm not going to introduce Crosby, except just to say this. We were sitting there listening to the sound check, and I looked over at my colleague, Jordan Dan, one of five unbelievably talented and wonderful staff members at the Writers Foundation. And there were tears streaming down her face. And I said, "It's nostalgic, isn't it? She said, "It's just this voice. It feels like home. I feel like I'm going home." And I thought, can't put any better than that. So please welcome Mr. Paul Zolo, who will introduce Mr. David Crosby. Thank you.
Good evening. You know, some human beings are just way, way more talented than all the rest of us. And tonight's guest is one of those. The truth is, just a few generations ago, it used to take about five people to do what he can do himself. It used to always take one lyricist and a composer to write a song, so two people to write one song, a singer, someone to arrange it, someone to play it. Tonight's guest does all those things, and he does them remarkably. Among songwriters, he's unique in that he's equally inventive and inspirational with words as with music. Most songwriters are one or the other. He's great with both, as you probably already know. And his career has been historic, and he's also a wonderful guy. So it's always exciting to get to be a place where you're with a songwriter playing songs that are everywhere at once. David Crosby's songs are everywhere at once, and yet we're going to be with him here tonight. So I'm very, very pleased to present our good friend, Mr. David Crosby.
Hi, you guys.
Let me see if this is, it's on in the house. Is this on in the monitor?
It's working. And there's a lot of love here in the house. I can feel it tonight. Feels good. This is David Crosby here. Well, I'm going to start asking questions, and we're going to let you write up some questions, too. And I'll start with the obvious question that everyone wonders, I'm sure, when you got David Crosby. And with Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young, how did you get top billing? How did that work?
Yeah, everybody thinks it must have been some great stratagem. It wasn't. If you say the names, try them in another order. Stills, Crosby, Nash.
Yeah,
Nash, Stills, Crosby. Young Nash, Stills, Crosby.
Yeah.
The Crosby, Stills, and Nash goes ba-ba-da-ba-da.
Yeah, it scans.
It falls off your tongue. And I knew that as soon as I put the three things together in my mind, so I just left the room. I knew that Stills wanted his name to be first.
Not surprising.
As a matter of fact, he and Neil staged a revolt at one point and had shirts made up that said Sync, S-Y-N-C.
Oh, right, right. Stills, Young, Nash, Crosby.
Yeah.
Sync.
Stephen finally got it.
Well, it's interesting to... I've interviewed Stephen recently, and to talk to you, it's kind of like the way Lennon and McCartney often will have different versions of who wrote the song, how it came together. Your versions of how things happened, it's a little different from Stephen's sometimes, to put it lightly. But just to clarify now, the story that I've been told is that you and Stills were singing, just the two of you, and you were singing at Mama Cass's house. He swore it. It's definitely Mama Cass's house.
Yeah, no, he always does.
He's wrong, huh?
He's totally wrong.
Well, the rest of the story very quickly.
We used to hang out there at Mama Cass's a lot because she was a dear friend of all of us. She's the one who introduced Nash and I to each other, and she was a very, very close friend. And we did sing there many times because we used to, when we did the first Crosby, Stills, and Nash album, we could sit down and sing you the whole album. Mm. We needed two guitarists, and that was it. We would just sit down and sing you the record, and we could do it anywhere, anytime. But I forgot what the question was.
Well,
this is going to be fun.
Yeah, I'll get you through. Well, the thing is.
Oh no, no! There was a specific thing.
I was getting to it.
No, but what was it?
Well, about it being at Mama Cass's that you and Stills were singing.
This is a very specific thing. It was at Joni's house.
It was at Joni's house.
Yeah, Joni's house.
Laurel Canyon.
Yeah, in Lookout Mountain Boulevard, or Lookout Mountain Road, it was Joni's house, very definitely. And Nash, if you don't believe me or Stills, ask Nash. He'll tell you Joni's house.
That I have.
Yeah.
Yeah, according to history, Nash heard the two of you singing. I believe it was You Don't Have to Cry.
Yeah.
Okay, Stephen was right about that, too. Yeah. And then Nash said, play it one more time.
No, he was right about that only.
And Nash listened twice, and then he joined in with the perfect harmony part.
Yeah, he listened to it twice, and he said, do that one more time.
Oh.
And Stills and I looked at each other, and we said, well, that's pushy, but okay. And so we sang it again, and he put the top harmony on, and right then we knew what we would be doing for the next large part of our lifetime.
And, to our ears, when we first heard that sound, that harmonic blend of your voices, the three of you, it was a miraculous sound. There are a few sounds like those three voices in harmony.
It's a very odd blend. Nash, of course, is from Manchester, and I'm a California kid off the beach, and Stills is born and raised in the South. So our voices are very different. Our accents are very different. There's just no reason why it works the way it does, except it does.
Well, when you first heard it, did it strike you in the same way? Because when we heard it...
Yeah,
absolutely. You knew?
Oh, yeah. I knew I was having a lot of fun singing with Stephen. I had been tossed out of the Birds.
There's so much to cover here. I don't know where to go.
It's absolutely true. Roger McGuinn and Chris Hillman came up to my house and said, we'd like you to leave the group. Because we'll do better without you.
Because some stories say it was the song Triad that they objected to.
I don't think Roger liked that song a lot. He was sort of straight, but I don't think that was the main thing. No, I was fairly difficult. I know it's difficult for you to believe this, but I wasn't angelic all the time. There were times, I think we were, young, talented guys with big egos, And I wanted more, you know, than being the harmony singer, quote unquote. I wanted them to do my songs. I wanted to, I wanted, you know, to have a more active part in it. And
well, given that, were you not inspired to just try a solo career, like a Joni or Jackson or James Taylor?
I could have.
Why did you want to get in a group?
Well, this is a longer story. When I was a kid, when I was about probably four, my mom took me to hear a symphony orchestra in the park. And we didn't have a lot of money, so she saw that there was a free concert, and she took me. And I was sitting right in the front. We got there early. And these people all sat down and they tuned up, and I loved the sound of the tuning up. It was so random. It was so wild. And then they struck up a song, you know, a piece, and it was so powerful. It just broke over me like a wave. It affected me very strongly. And something about, I noticed that some of the power came from, they were all doing it together. All the elbows were going at the same time, and all the drums were going, everything was, the power, I got it, came from that they were all doing it together. And I guess it really stuck in my head, because I have always preferred making music with another human being or other human beings than doing it by myself. I've done many solo tours, and there are things you can do when you're by yourself, you know, vocally and stuff, that are you can take more chances. Mm-hmm. But something about that link up. When you play music by yourself, it's a joy. When you play music with another human being, there's an interchange that goes on. And if it's really good, but somebody like Nash, you wind up with a telepathic exchange going on. And then if you take that and put it out past the footlights to the audience, there's an energy that comes back from it that you just simply really can't believe. It's very strong, and it's palpable, and it's not just the sound that you make. There's a really strong energy that comes from an audience. So being in a group was always kind of what I wanted to do.
Were you and Stills considering being a duo, or did you want a third person?
I don't know if we were considering much of anything. We were just screwing around.
Right.
You know, we were a pair of young bozos.
Writing some pretty good songs at the time.
We were writing some pretty good songs. Yeah. We were mostly running around rubbing the velvet off our antlers, you know.
You know, you once told me that there are two things you knew how to do when you were born, that you could sail and that you could sing harmony. Even before anyone taught you how to sing harmony, you kind of had that at the age of six. And I don't know if everyone realizes it, but when David sings with Crosby, Stills, and Nash, he's almost always the middle part, which is the toughest part to do. It's the glue that holds the other parts together, and without that part, the core doesn't work. And he comes up with very extraordinary harmony parts.
Odd, yeah. I've been accused of being odd.
So when you and Stills and Nash would sit down with a new song, would you work out harmony parts, or would it just kind of fall together?
You could call it working it out. You could call it falling together. It's a pretty loose process. Mm-hmm. Whoever wrote the song, bring it to the other guys and say, you know, I got this new one, you know, listen to this or listen to this. And while we're listening to it, even the very first time, you know, things start to jump into your head, you know, because it's what I do, and it's what Nash does. We're harmony singers. It's what we love. And before you get to the end of it the second time, we'll have the parts, usually. Sometimes before you get to the end of it the first time.
It's always kind of a... Sorry.
And then we work on them, you know, after that. It's not like we don't, you know, apply some craft to the thing, but mostly it comes naturally very easily.
It's always fascinating to hear any of you sing one of your famous songs solo, because where the melody is isn't obvious from hearing the record, because the parts intertwine, kind of like the Beatles did. And I mentioned that to Stills, and he goes, yes, we were very clever boys.
I would have said we listened to the Beatles a lot.
Oh, is that it?
And there's this basic difference there. You gotta understand, I do love Stephen. He's a good guy, and he's been my partner forever, and I hope he will be my partner forever. But we disagree about lots of stuff, and we've learned to live with that.
Well, speaking of disagreements between you and Still, since we're on the topic, though Crosby, Stills, and Nash were a team, very rarely did you write songs together. However, the exception, of course, is Wooden Ships, classic Wooden Ships, which was first credited to Wooden Ships. This man wrote that song. It was credited to you and Stills, and then Paul Kantner later got credit.
Well, there was a trick to that, too. What happened was Paul and the Jefferson Airplane had a very bad manager. The guy was such a shit that I remember his name. His name was Matthew Cates. It takes a lot to make me remember a guy's name. And he was a real piece of work. And he was suing them at the time. So Paul called me up and said, listen, you better not put my name on the Crosby, Stills, and Nash record, or he can, because right then he had an injunction against them releasing their record. And we didn't want to take a chance on him putting an injunction on us because Paul was one of the writers. So Paul told me to do it.
Yeah,
and I made sure, and we all made sure that he, you know, got credit later.
Well, the way the story goes, and it goes different ways, is that you were on your ship, the Mayan, and you had a bit of Wooden Ships, and Kantner had a few lines.
No, I had all the music.
This, I'll read you Still's quotes. I feel like Tim Russert here now.
Don't do it. It'll just piss me off.
Well, just one line is funny. I said, did you discuss what the song was about, or did you write it instinctually? He said, dude, there's no telling what we discussed that evening. It was one of those overwrought hippie things. The boat was humming, if you will.
Yeah, he doesn't know what it's about.
But he said he took the song and... He said he took it and finished it.
No,
off
he did
and
not.
It up to you.
Okay. Yeah, I knew you had to get that line in. You just...
Sorry.
Now I'm pissed.
I'll be good from now on.
I'll be pissed all night at you. Just because you went ahead and did that.
I should have ended
kidding.
With that. You
know? No, he did not finish the song. What he did was he thought up the verse, horror grips you as we watch you die.
That sounds like Stills.
That verse, he definitely did think up the words to. There's no question about it. He did. But I wrote all the music, and Paul wrote the rest of the lyrics with me.
And you had a sci-fi idea in mind when you were writing?
Yeah, it's a post-apocalyptic sort of a thing. The silver people on the shoreline are people in radiation suits. It was one of those things after everything came unglued. We're a very odd generation. You know, we grew up, we're the first generation to grow up with a full stop in our dictionary. We grew up with people telling us that the human race could actually be wiped out. That all life on the planet could be wiped out, which for a little kid is, you know, duck and cover doesn't quite handle that. And it was in our heads, you know, particularly Paul and I both read a lot of science fiction. We both grew up on Robert Heinlein, and Paul's written a number of science fiction songs. I've only written that one, you know. But. Mm.
A thing about your work and that song particularly that's extraordinary to me is that they're so free. They don't follow any rules. They're not necessarily symmetrical. That one has dialogue in it. And you write it from the beginning. We're stretching the song form in new ways that no one ever had done.
I didn't know the rules. That's a great freedom. I have consciously tried to, not pay any attention to the accustomed way of writing songs. You know, verse, chorus, verse, chorus, bridge, verse, chorus. I do write some like that, but I try, pretty much unconsciously, I just do weirder stuff than that. It's always been my job in the group is to write the weird shit. Well, Deja Vu is weird. It's an odd song. It doesn't go where you think it's going to go. And that's... typical of me.
Mm-hmm. And the thing about looking over your whole body of work now is there's not one song that seems contrived, that you sat down like, I'm going to write a hit now or a pop song.
I can't do it.
No?
I know people who can. They can sit down and say, I'm going to write a song about the Eiffel Tower. It's big and it's tall and it's made out of iron. And I can't do that. I just effing can't. I just can't. Stuff comes to me. And more often than not, it's about love. It's about, you know, love lost, love found, love unrequited, love celebrated. And as you get older, of course, you know, it goes from being, you know, love and lust to being family love. I've written a lot of songs, particularly in the more recent time when I've been writing with my son James. I wrote a lot of songs about Jan, which is kind of natural. We've been together 30 years, and I'm in love with her. So.
And she's here tonight, and she's a great lady. So have you ever sat down with an idea, like I want to write a song about a topic, or do they kind of emerge and then you follow them more than lead them?
Sometimes I do. I do it every which way. I've been trying to write, you know, shit. I have been trying to write a good song about America for a long time. Well, you know, it's a tough one, man. I really love this country. I really love it. I believe in the Constitution. I believe in the Declaration of Independence. I believe in the Bill of Rights. I think it's the best defense of freedom there's ever been. It's the greatest country in the world. And those documents are the best, finest attempt at finding a way for us all to live together under the rule of law that there's ever been. There's the other side of the coin. We don't want to get too political.
Too late.
But we will. You know, I don't like the politicians that try to drag it their way away from the Constitution and away from the Bill of Rights and away from the Declaration of Independence. I never have, and I most assuredly don't like George Bush. Yeah. Let me ask you a question. This is just a question, because this has been bothering me. Let me ask you. Don't you think it would be a good idea to have a law that says you can't have nuclear weapons unless you can pronounce the word nuclear?
I agree.
I just think, you know, it would...
I think that's a good law.
Kind of a...
I have an 8-year-old son.
I'd feel so much safer.
Yeah.
Hey, come
my,
here.
My son can say it. He's 8. He knows the difference.
Come here, guys. Come on in. Come on up on the upper floor. Here, now, press the red button. Watch. It's really fun. Try it. Just press the red one.
Well, I found one of the most moving expressions of your love of this country is your version of My Country, Tis of Thee. Have you heard that? Isn't that gorgeous? There's nothing like it.
It's a good song. We were almost going to do that in the CSNY Freedom of Speech tour that we did last summer, which was really fun. We definitely stirred up some trouble that time.
Oh yeah,
boy, when you'll see, 95% of the people really loved what we were saying, and I think you would too. But there was a very vocal and quite drunk part of the audience in Atlanta in particular, who were really, but you can't say that about George, goddammit. I'd like to kill that Neil Young, that some bitch. And so we had cameras going. We had 5 cameras on the stage, but we had another 5 in the audience. And all of those people, we got them all on camera. We got all the ones who got there at 9 o'clock and were tailgating, you know, because they love our music and they always have. And then we got these people who were. Well, I think it's just a crime that we paid, whatever it was, you know, all that money to come in here and we came to listen to songs. How dare they say bad things about the president like that and all that nonsense? I don't know whose concert they thought they were going to. Because, you know, maybe it's, how do you say his name? Barely Man Enough? Barry Manilow. That's it. Maybe that's what they thought. Maybe that's the concert they thought they were going to, but they come to a CSNY show and expect no politics, man. You have to be some seriously dumb. You know, Ohio, long time gone, for what it's worth. Military madness. It's not like this is a new thing with us. We've been doing it for a while. So I found it, you know, a great deal of fun. And as usual, I forgot where you started.
Doesn't really matter.
I'm really glad you're here, Paul.
I'm glad to be here.
You'll remember everything.
I'll try. We'll tape it, too, so we can remember.
Yeah.
When you write a song, I mean, sometimes you've told me you've had lyrics for a song, a whole lyric you'll write. Sometimes, like today, you played a whole new song that was just music. They come all different ways?
Every which way, yeah. Sometimes the lyric will jump full-blown into your head. Shadow Captain comes to mind. I was in my sailboat, and I was off the coast of California, about 150 miles out, and I was off watch, and it was about 4 o'clock in the morning, and I woke up, grabbed a pad of paper, wrote the entire thing, word for word, exactly the way you heard it on the record, and went back to sleep.
Wow.
Just... When I got to Shadow Captain of a Charcoal Ship, I went, Cross, you cool.
Good line.
That's cool. Trying to give the light the slip. Yeah, I loved it.
Words
I forgot all about it. Till morning. Breakfast was really good that morning. Woke up to that. Yeah, they come every which way. The one that I was playing you earlier, I'll play it for them if you want.
Good. I was just told that they want you to take your guitars out of the case because they don't want to touch them. But we have two guitars here, actually, that are very beautiful.
Well, they're just for help.
Yeah.
They're just for help.
It's not a concert.
I'll sing a couple of songs, but...
Yeah. But, do you have any ideas when a song like that comes to you full-blown? And many great songwriters have said the best songs have come like that. Where does that come from? Do you have any idea?
I don't. I can give you a clue, though. What I found is that many times I would write right when I was falling asleep. And what I think it is I think that as you're falling asleep, the busy mind, the verbal crystallization level of your mind that's talking to you right now is falling asleep. It's cacking out. And another level, let's call it intuitive imaginative level, a level that makes longer leaps of connection, gets a shot at the steering wheel for a second. Because suddenly, just as I'm drifting off, I will write lyrics. And it's happened hundreds of times. So I think that there is a part of my mind that is subconsciously putting stuff together. Because there's no conscious, okay, insert tab A and slot B. I don't really do that very much.
Well, you know, songwriting is an unusual art. I mean, it's an art and a craft. That in that you can't teach it to someone, but you can learn it. But right from the very beginning, you were writing very sophisticated songs. Your first song, you don't think so?
No, you haven't heard the ones I wrote at the beginning.
Okay. It didn't start like that?
Yeah, my first song wasn't all that good.
What was it called?
It was called Cross the Plains.
That's a nice title.
It was pure unadulterated corn.
Uh-huh. They're wanting to hear it, of course. No. But all songwriters start like that. When you were starting writing songs, were you emulating anybody? Was there a certain artist or songwriter, singers that you were emulating?
Beatles.
Oh, yeah, that was it, huh?
Yeah, Beatles. I grew up on a lot of what made me sing the way I do and make me want to sing harmony is the Everly Brothers.
Ah.
But, the Champs, they pretty much wrote the book. But the Beatles took it further, and their lyrics were so good, and their, you know, jeez, Eleanor Rigby. How do you get to there? How do you get to where you can write a song like that? That's so brave. Write a song about old people alone in the dark? Come on. You know, we write, you know, ooh, baby, I love you. You got nice buns, you know. We don't write Eleanor Rigby.
Well, they started with those pretty simple ones, too.
Yeah, absolutely they did. Yeah. Absolutely they did. We all do.
But
they grew so fast, so far.
As did you. It seems to me, though, when I think of Lennon and McCartney, that McCartney would often write story songs, like Eleanor Rigby, about someone else outside of his life, where Lennon was writing about himself a lot. Though not always, but that you seem to write more about yourself and your life, and you're making statements right out of what you do. Is that true?
I try, but it's not a conscious... I say I try, and I don't really. I don't have a conscious aim in doing it. I just want to write something that rings true and that feels good to me and that makes you feel something. That's my job, is to help you feel something, to put you, in a place where you feel something. Now, that can be triumph, it can be sadness, it can be joy, it can be love, it can be anger, it can be almost anything. But if I can make people feel something, then I think it's good art. That's my criterion for art, is if you look at a painting and it does nothing to you, then I don't care how expensive it is. It doesn't do anything to me. If I look at a painting and it makes me feel something strongly, well, then it's good art to me.
Would you, when you were working on a song, would you ever try to force the process, or do you pretty much let it happen? Do you need inspiration to make it work?
I've done both. Yeah. I try to be patient with them because I think they come out better that way. Mm. And you really never know how a song is going to come out. Give you an example. There's a song that I wrote, and it started out as a jam. It's called What Are Their Names? Mm. And it was a... He likes that one.
I did.
And it started out as a jam. Garcia and I and some other people were just...
Phil Lesh?
Neil Young? Phil? I don't know if...
Neil was on.
Neil was on. Was he?
I've done my homework.
I'll bet you $5 he wasn't on it.
All right.
Anyway... He had a large part in changing that song, though, because we did it for the record, and then I never did it again, pretty much. And Neil, when we were getting ready for the Freedom of Speech tour, I went over to him and I sang in his ear, and I said, "Remember that song? I think that song would fit in this show." And what he did was he got everybody to sing. Can you guys sing? Okay. Ooh, sing that with me. No, with me, not after. Whoa. That's it. Whoa, who are the men who really run this land? And why do they run it with such a thoughtless hand? What are their names? And on what streets do they live? I'd like to ride right over in the afternoon and give them a piece of my mind about peace for mankind. Peace is not an awful lot to ask." And that's how it wound up.
Yeah. Nice.
You're a good singer.
Yeah.
You had confidence. Stepped right in there where it was supposed to be.
Mm-hmm. And then it was nice on the record. You got quite a nice choir to sing that. You had Joni on that and Grace Slick and pretty nice people.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a very odd time in my life. We had just made Deja Vu. And in the process of making Deja Vu, the girl that I was in love with got killed. And... pretty much destroyed me. I didn't have any way to deal with it at all. I wasn't equipped for that. And so I couldn't really do much else except be in the studio. And sometimes I would go in the studio and just sit on the floor and cry. And mostly I would go in the studio and work on some song or another, and my friends would stop by. And that's how that record happened. It wasn't even supposed to be a record. We just, I didn't know what else to do. And so we stayed in the studio, and Garcia, God bless him, and Nash came by every night, and Lesh many nights. And it was, you know, it was good chemistry. It was fun.
Yeah, it's a beautiful album. Music is Love is on that album, and a lot of great stuff. Special songs. Yeah. You know, I wanted to ask you, we were talking about CSN, and then Neil came in. And a lot of us, a lot of us never understood you. You got Crosby.
Here comes Neil.
But you got Crosby, Stills, and Nash, three amazing singers, great songwriters, and then you bring in another really amazing artist.
Well, it worked like this. There were two main reasons. One, on the record, Crosby, Stills, and Nash record, Stephen played both keyboard and guitar. He's a very bright lad that way. And he knew that when he had to play guitar, we needed somebody else. When he had to play keyboard, somebody else was going to have to play guitar. And also, he knew that Neil was terrific. Mm. I didn't really. I knew that he was good. I didn't realize how good. But in... It's either Joni's or Elliot Roberts, a manager. One of their two driveways, I was sitting there waiting, and Neil drove by, saw me, pulled in, sat down. We sat down on the trunk of a car, and he sang me, oh, I don't know, four songs. And I definitely wanted to be in the same group with that guy.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, come on. He sang...
Helpless?
Helpless. Cowgirl. A couple others. You can't not want to. He's one of the best songwriters alive.
Still said he had other ideas for other people in the band, including John Sebastian, he thought might be a good one.
Yeah, John was a friend of ours, all of us, and we thought, you know, well, he could learn bass, you know. He could... We did think about it, and there were a couple other people that we tried out for, you know, bass and drums and keyboards and stuff, but it fell together the way it fell, and, you know, I'm pretty happy about it.
Yeah, it worked out pretty well. But as four guys, as you said, with healthy egos, was it ever tough for you to share so much space with other songwriters to not have your own songs featured that much in concerts and on records?
No, because, you know, what we did was we kept our solo, you know, lives intact by using our own names. We didn't call ourselves, you know, the whatever, the Bazabazabas, because we wanted to be able to split off and do solo stuff, split off and do stuff in pairs for me and Nash, and come back to the mothership of the group. Mm. So, no, it was we intended to do it. Mm. And truthfully, when you juxtapose your best song next to three other guys' best songs, it's stronger than you putting your four best songs together, mm-hmm. usually.
Yeah, those are some pretty amazing albums. We mentioned John Sebastian, and I just realized he actually plays harmonica on Deja Vu. Mm-hmm. It's a little trivia for you. And as we're talking about, Deja Vu is not a normal song. It's a very special song. It doesn't have a normal structure. The title itself isn't even in the song. How did it come together? Where did the title come from? Did that come later to call it Deja Vu?
It came from me having a very strong feeling that I had been here before. Some of that came from acid trips, and some of that came from... Some of it came from knowing how to sail the first time I sat in a sailboat. And some of it came from feeling as if I had, you know, done music before. Because it definitely felt as if I had. Mm.
And did you come up with the title after you wrote the song? Jarring the memory now. It's a good title.
That's tough. The sequence of events is pretty tough. Yeah. But I was happy about the title. It's a very odd song, and it's an odd tuning.
It's interesting, too, that a lot of people don't realize there's a big difference between a song and a record. But you can write a great song and then make a bad record of it. But you guys were really great at capturing the spirit of your songs. And, you know, I was listening to that many times last night. And the spirit is kind of has a spontaneous feel. You start kind of chanting before the count. And then there's a count, and then the band kind of kicks in. It works,
you know,
great.
I like what we do, too.
To me, it seems difficult when you're writing a song like that to capture it. It seems a song like that would be elusive as opposed to a verse that repeats a cyclical song. How would you
capture
something
like that? Well, that's what Nash said. Nash thought I was crazy. You know, I sent him a tape of it. And, well, hang on.
Oh, good. It's getting the guitar. I was hoping. It's David Crosby. Happens to have brought beautiful guitars.
Thank you.
There's a white Pinto with its lights on. No, sorry. Thank you.
Oh, don't get all excited. I'm not going to play a whole bunch. I'm just going to show you how the song goes.
You can get excited.
It's not what lyrically speaking is about. But in the first place...
Have another drink.
That's not a normal tuning. And if I had ever been here before, I would probably know just what to do. Don't you? If I had ever been here before, another time around the wheel, I would probably know just how to deal with all of you.
This is the best seat I've ever had. So this is great.
Yeah, when you come to the next one, you'll be behind a pillar.
Yeah, where I usually am. You know, when I hear those tunings, you said once that when you were starting, you really loved Coltrane and McCoy Tyner and those kind of jazz harmonies. And a lot of people said, you know, Crosby, the Byrds, it's folk rock. But it's more than that. You really brought jazz and jazz harmonies.
Well, you know,
it.
People kept trying to label it as folk rock, and then when I listened to a lot of Ravi Shankar, and we started trying to inject some of that, and it was always raga rock, and then I played a bunch of John Coltrane, and it's a funny story. We were on tour, and everybody else was in a big bus, and we had already tried that, and it was a really pretty horror show, so we got ourselves a Winnebago. So we could herbally enhance ourselves as we were. And we stopped at a, we're stopped and we've got a Fender basement in the back of the thing facing forward with a reel-to-reel tape recorder. This is so ancient. And we're playing John Coltrane's Africa Brass. And we pull up to a railroad crossing, and the sign is down, and the train comes, and lo and behold, this is how stoned we were, a coal train goes. Ah. Train full of coal. Ooh, cosmic. Dude, did you see that?
That's funny.
Funny stuff. It was funny stuff.
You know, we were talking about capturing a song in the studio. To get the Crosby, Stills, Nash blend, that sound on tape, would you guys sing together at the same time?
Very, very often we did, yeah. And it's an air blend, and it's much harder to do. Because if one guy screws up, everybody screwed up, and you have to start over. Nowadays, with Pro Tools and stuff like that, it just doesn't make sense to do it, because if you do them separately, you can do anything to them you want. You can say the P on that people is a little before the P on the other people's people. So we're just going to take it and move it that much.
Is that good to have that?
I don't know. It is. It exists. And if a tool exists, people will use it.
Sure.
You know.
Some people have said to get a blend, you have to all be on the same mic even. Did you do that?
You have to. To get a blend, you have to sing an air blend with each other to rehearse it and to learn it. You don't necessarily have to do it that way to get a great record. We did many vocals that way and many every other way. When you listen to something like Helplessly Hoping, that would be an air blend. That would be an air blend. Any time that it was three voices and one guitar or two guitars, we would sing it that way.
Last night, I was listening to all your songs, and I listened to Almost Cut My Hair.
You listened to all my songs in one night?
Well, not all of them, okay. Quite a few, though, I did. It was a good night. Yeah, well, over. Anyway, I understand that, I mean, that vocal line, Almost Cut My Hair, is so emotional and so passionate. And I heard that Steven said it was too raw for him. He didn't even want to put it out. But then later, Neil came up to you and said, you know, that's the best song on the album. How much of that is true?
It's true.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's all true.
Yeah.
I thought that Steven and Neil played so great on it.
Yeah.
That, you know, there is a thing that they do together with two guitars that nobody else does. And it's when they get it right, it's mind-blowing. It's like an audio bulldozer. You can't ignore it. And they got it right.
Yeah.
That was a very exciting time.
Were you singing while they were playing?
Yeah, that's a live take. Live guitarist, live vocal, live everything, one pass.
Yeah, because Neil's guitar solo is much more raw than Stills, but it works so well, the two of them together.
Neil was at that stage of the game where his solos were, how many notes can I squeeze into? You know, pretty intense.
Yeah, but it worked.
Intense guy.
That song, and you've said that you don't think it's one of your best songs, but it's a very powerful song. Almost.
You know, I like it. I like singing it because I like the reaction it gets, and I like singing rock and roll. I mean, come on, you know, I like singing, you know, ballads too. But well, we're screwed. You know, I don't have a band, but next time I'll bring a band.
I want to come too.
Well, this was more about how we write the songs than a performance, but I think, you know, you'll probably like it. You'll probably like it, and I promise I will bring a band next time I come.
Yeah. Another classic of yours is "Long Time Gone," and that's when I understand that you had trouble getting the feel you wanted when you were recording.
And that one is a case where Stephen really did come through really amazingly.
Well, he was telling the truth on that one.
Yeah, no, he absolutely was. He built the track for that song. I wasn't even there. Oh. I sang it to him. We made a demo of it earlier, which a radio personality friend of ours dubbed "The Frozen Noses." I don't know why he called us that, but we had a demo of it that was interesting, you know. But I did not have a track like that. Stephen built that track from scratch, and he played the bass, the organ, and the guitar, all three. Mm-hmm. So when he tells you that he sometimes is Captain Many Hands, he is. Mm-hmm. Sometimes he absolutely is, and he's a talented guy. You know, I'll be the first one to say it.
And the story goes that then you came in the next day and heard what he had done the previous night, and you sang it with a new passion that you hadn't sung it with before, and you said, you know, I've really found my voice for the first time with this track and the song.
Yeah, I think it was one of the first times I really sang rock and roll right.
So I was surprised. You said when you were in the Byrds that if you sang lead, you would choke up a little bit. And that surprised me.
I didn't think of myself as a lead singer.
Oh, yeah?
You know, I had always been a harmony singer.
Oh.
So, you know, I still don't think I'm that good a lead singer. I mean, not compared to Stephen or...
He's a humble man.
No, come on, gang. Let's think about it realistically.
But that voice...
James Taylor.
Pavarotti.
Okay? Let's talk about a real voice. Let's go James Taylor, Joni Mitchell, you know, okay?
I would agree.
Well, I love you too, but no. Jerry wasn't a good singer, but he was a great singer. But he wasn't a good singer. He would have been the first to tell you that. He would have been the first to tell you that. What Jerry could do is he could tell you a story with this song. Mm. He could involve you and inveigle you into coming along, you know. And that was powerful stuff. I really loved that guy a lot.
But, you know, when you would sing a lead, there's so much soul in your lead vocals, like in Long Time Gone. It's very soulful. And there's a sound, a quality in your voice that no one else has.
How do you answer that?
You don't have to answer that.
Well, yes, actually, I.
Yes. Stills would have no problem with it.
I think I'm pretty terrific, too. Thank you.
Do you think a little bit of Long Time Gone? Can we hear a little bit?
No. It's really a band song. I can sing it, but not in this tuning. I can sing it, but not
we got
in
two
tuning.
Guitars.
But
it's a normal tuning.
That's very definitely not normal tuning.
I asked him what the tuning was on this guitar earlier, and he said it's Guinevere tuning. Yeah. You know what that means, huh?
Well, I usually name them after the, you know, whatever was the first song in that tuning that I wrote. It's a great story on this guitar. I play dreadnoughts, always have, big-bodied Martins, love them, and I'm still playing them. But this guy showed up at my house, and McAllister, Roy McAllister was his name, and he used to work at Santa Cruz Guitars, and he showed up at my house and said, "Hey, Mr. Crosby, I made your guitar." And I thought, oh, shit. First of all, nine times out of ten, it's a piece of crap guitar. And you have to be nice, you know, because they're trying to give you something. They're trying to tell you they love you. And secondly, you know, I have my guitarist. I don't need any guitarists. And I said that to him. I said, listen, I don't really need any more guitarists. And he said, well, I made this one for you. You try it. And I said, well, I can't afford another guitar right now. He said, I'm giving it to you. Okay. So I sit down, and it's a pretty little guitar, very plain. And it's the best guitar I have. I love it dearly. This one here, there's a guy, a lawyer in Houston, Texas, who made a lot of money with class action suits, tobacco and asbestos and stuff. And so he has this huge estate in Houston, and every year he throws a party for, you know, 5,000 or 6,000 of his closest friends. And he hires somebody like us or Fleetwood or Doobies or, you know, Steely Dan, you know, a band from our era. And so we were pretty good that day. We aren't always, but we were then. And he came up and he was looking at my guitars afterwards and saying, you know, geez, I really like that one. Geez, that custom J200 Rose. I'd never seen a Rosewood J200 before. And we were going back and forth about it. He says, how come you don't have an Olsen? And I said, isn't that what James plays? He said, yeah. And I said, well, the way I hear it, those are like $20,000, $25,000 guitars, and I really can't afford one. And he said, I'll give it to you. Now, I'm no hooker. It took me at least 0.2 seconds to say yes. I didn't roll over easy, I want you to know. So I, who played dreadnoughts all my life, wound up with my two best guitars being concert size, and I didn't pay for either of them. It's crazy.
It's good to be David Crosby.
Sometimes. When you go into prison in Texas, it's not. You Crosby?
No.
Hi there, rock star. Go ahead, man. I'm sorry.
Well, we were trying to encourage you to do a little of Long Time Gone. Would you mind? Just a touch?
It's the simplest song in the world. It's been a long time coming, going to be a long time gone, and it appears to be a long, appears to be a long, appears to be a long time, such a long, long time before the dawn.
Thank you.
This was in regular tuning.
Nice.
More to come.
You know, we were talking, you said once that you like songs that have a topic, songs that have content. And often we'll hear songs nowadays that don't even have any nouns in them. They're like emotionally empty songs. I got my notes in. But you've always written songs that are about something. Like The Triad is a song using content that really no one else ever even touched before. The idea, like, why can't we go on as three, having a romance or a love affair with three people instead of two? How did that song happen?
let's see.
The question, did you have the idea for
the
song?
We're in dangerous waters here. I have to figure out how to navigate this.
Was the concept there before
the
song?
In the early part of my life. The very early, ancient part of my life, way back before I met my wife. Way before I met my dearly beloved wife. I occasionally used to go out with girls. And somehow it all got mixed up and there were two of them there. Sometimes. And I don't know how that happened. I must have gotten confused. I think it could have been a side effect of my medications.
But do you have any memory when you wrote that song? This song hasn't been written before. I'm in uncharted waters here.
Didn't really think about it. I don't generally think of myself that way, the way you do or the way someone else does outside, because you wind up standing there saying, gosh, I'm significant. What a fantastic person I am. And it just doesn't help at all. You know, I've already got a big ego, you know, because I've done a bunch of stuff and I'm proud of myself and things like that. But it doesn't help to try to look at yourself the way the rest of the world does. I put my pants on one leg at a time. I can be an incredibly stupid person. And I'm most assuredly, you know, not some kind of hero. So I find it's healthier to look at myself that way.
You know, when you sang that song on Four Way Street, you famously, and they left in your spoken introduction that, you know, we take these songs right out of what we're doing, and sometimes for that reason they're hard to sing. And for one thing, it was moving that they left that introduction on. It always touched us. When you said that, we listened to the song in a different way.
Which song was it?
And for Try It.
It was Try It, yeah. Well,
it had
a pretty solid emotional content to it. There are other ones that are harder to sing than that. Carry Me's harder to sing than that.
Oh, yeah?
Carry Me's probably one of the most difficult ones of all.
Ah.
In which case?
Yeah, it's also one of your most joyful songs, I find, Carry Me.
Well, it depends on which part you're listening to.
Yeah.
When I was a young man, battered and worn on one as you have ever seen. But I made it some new wings, and I painted the nose, and I wished so hard up in the air I rode singing, carry me, carry me, yeah, carry me above this world. Carry me, carry me, carry me above the world. I once loved a girl younger than me. Parents kept her locked up in their life, and she was crying at night, wishing she could be free. Of course, I mostly remember her laughing, standing and dancing and watching us play. For a while there, music would take her away, and she'd be singing, carry me. Singing, carry me above this world. Carry me, yeah, carry me above the world. And then there was my mother. She was lying in white sheets there, waiting to die. She said, if you reach underneath my bed and untie these weights, I could surely fly. She was smiling, but she was tired. She'd like to hear that last bell ring. You know, if she still could, she would stand up. And she could sing, carry me. Sing it, carry me. Carry me above this world. Carry me. Carry me, carry me, oh please carry me, please carry me above the world.
Bravo.
Yeah. It's an amazing song. And I think it's the most joyful song, or one of your most joyful songs, because you deal with sorrow, but it's about transcending that sorrow.
Yeah, it's a song of transcendence, no question.
You once said that line about your mother, if you take away these weights, I could surely fly.
That's what she said.
She said that to you.
She said that to me, yeah. She was dying, lying there. She had cancer. And you know how it is. They stretch it out. They keep you alive way past when you would have liked to have left with what dignity you had left. And she wanted to go. As a matter of fact, she asked me to help her.
Yeah.
And I was going to. I talked to a couple of doctor friends and found out how to do it. And then I went to her and I said, okay, I found out how to do it. I will help you. I will do it. And she said, well, no, I talked to some people too. And if I die off schedule, if I die before the schedule, they'll do an autopsy, figure out what she did, and charge her with murder. So she wouldn't let me do it. Mm.
Did you finish that song while she was with us, or was that later?
No, I wish I had. I would have loved to have sung it to her.
Yeah, it's quite a beautiful song.
Thank you.
Was that one where you were consciously putting that song together, or did that...
It just came like that.
Yeah.
I don't do that, like I said, tab A, slot B, mm-hmm. construction of a song very well. Yeah. There are other people who do. Johnny, write me a song about the mic stand. Okay. 2 hours later, she's got the most brilliant song you ever heard in your life, and it's about a mic stand. It's a mic stand in Saskatchewan, and it was a rainy night. And the truck broke down, and you know, I think in the long run, in 100 years from now, that they will look back and they will say, you know, well, okay, it's Joni or Dylan, and Joni's as good a poet as Bob is, I think, personally, and a much better musician.
Well,
hate to admit a mere little girl could be better than all us boys, but I'm afraid she is.
But I find Joni is... Her work is similar to yours in that her music is every bit as adventurous as the lyrics.
Yeah.
And like you, she uses those unusual tunings and reaches harmonic places that other people don't get near.
Yeah. She was very... It was a very interesting experience being with Joni. When I produced her first record, I was also her old man at the time. And
you really launched her career. Just to, if you, in case you don't know, you got her record contract, right?
Yeah, it was a.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I have to do something good every once in a while, even if it's by accident.
That's a big one.
It was a very interesting experience. Falling in love with Joni is a little like falling into a cement mixer. She is a turbulent girl.
Wow.
To put it nicely.
And every one of you had a romance with her, didn't you? I mean, all your friends, right? I mean, suddenly
except
this is like
Steven.
E-television here.
Except Stephen.
Okay.
You have to draw the line someplace.
Yeah. That's good.
Oh, that's so bad. Bartender, do you have a small glass of Cabernet back there that
or two?
Would you like to join me?
I'd like to drink with David. But you know, speaking of Joni, you miraculously, you're one of the only people in history who have collaborated on a song with Joni. I mean, she writes pretty great music and words, but you guys wrote Yvette in English together. You know that song, Yvette in English? It's a
probably
fantastic
not.
Song.
We both recorded it. It's a good song.
It's on two albums. It's on Thousand Roads.
Yeah.
And she recorded it.
Yeah. It was an amazing experience. I don't know if anybody has ever written a song. Do you know? I mean, you're the guy. Do you know if anybody else has written a song?
She's adapted some songs from poems and from the Bible, but no collaborations that I know of.
Yeah. And I was thrilled. I had a set of lyrics that I thought was somewhat like her style. Thank you very much.
This is nice sitting next to David Crosby.
Your health.
Cheers. L'chaim.
L'chaim. The French tell me that this is good for you, so they wouldn't lie.
But how did Yvette in English come about? I understand you had a lyric.
I had a lyric that I wrote in a car on the way from Tokyo out to I can almost come up with it. What's the name of the big airport at Tokyo?
Narita.
That's it, Narita. And it's a long drive, and I wrote these lyrics, and I showed them to Joni. I went to Joni when I was doing this album, Thousand Roads. I was doing other people's songs, except for one song of mine, which was called Thousand Roads. And I went to Joni. I said, Joni, you know, I know that you don't do this, but do you have a song of yours that I could do? I'm your biggest fan in the world. I love your music more than anybody else on the planet. And I'm doing other people's music, and it would just be a crime to do a record where I didn't sing one of your songs. Now, I've sung her song for free for years, but I wanted to do a new one. And she said, well, I don't have one right now. And I said, well, I got some lyrics, which was pretty brave. Gee, Mr. Einstein, I've got a formula here. It was tough being her old man, I'll tell you. I would come home and I'd go, Joni, wait till you hear this. Guinevere had green eyes. Sound like you, huh? Kind of pretty, huh? And she'd sit down and sing me three songs that were better in a row and say she wrote them that morning.
Oh, God.
It's very tough.
I mean, when you first heard her, you recognized that that was something very special there.
Yes, more ways than one, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was very hard not to fall in love with her just looking at her, you know, listening to her sing. She was in a coffee house in Florida, and she was singing, you know, Michael from Mountains or Both Sides Now or something like that. And I just went, you know. Imagine if you had run into her with no warning.
Yeah.
Nowadays, I mean, it's Joni Mitchell. Watch out.
Right.
She's going to fuck with your head.
Yeah.
I could have used that warning. I really could.
You produced your first album, and producing a record wasn't something you've done much before then or since. So
it was a very simple thing to do. All you had to do was keep crap off it.
Yeah. So you purposely understated it.
She was already playing the whole arrangement in her guitar.
Yeah.
She didn't need a band and stuff. So I tried to record what was there.
Oh.
Worked out.
Yeah. It sure did. Pretty amazing stuff. You know, you were saying how Carry Me is maybe the most difficult song for you to sing.
Actually, no. Guinevere.
No? Guinevere?
It's probably harder.
Why is that? Why is it harder?
Well, you will. I was going to end with it. I was going to end with it because it's probably my best song.
Well, then let's wait.
Yeah, we'll wait. Yeah. But it's a very difficult song to sing, too, because obviously, you know, one of the main people in it that I wrote about it had already died, and it was, you know, like I said, that was not an easy thing.
Were there ever any songs that you couldn't perform, that you didn't put on records, that were just too close to the bone?
No. Close to the bone is good.
Yeah. Well.
You just have to steel yourself up to it and do it.
And you've done it.
Delta was very hard, too.
Ah.
Delta, well, Delta is a song about being lost. And I, as you all know, I'm sure I spent a long time lost. And so when I do it, it takes me to a place that that's difficult for me. But I love doing the song because, wow.
All right. We got a piano just for this song.
Now, I don't usually perform this because I'm not really a piano player at all. So if I fudge it up, you just have to forgive me. There's an interesting story to this, too. I had this song partway. And this is when I was doing hard drugs and I was in pretty bad shape. And I was at a friend of mine's house in Montecito, California, and Jackson came over. Now, Jackson, I've known Jackson since he was 19. I did all the harmonies on his first record. And I love him dearly. He's a truly good human being. Anyway, he listened to the part that I had and said, "Cross, that's a good song. You need to finish it." And I said, "Well, I don't have a piano." He said, "Well, let's go. We'll go over to Zevon's house. He's got a piano." And so he took me over to Warren's house and sat me down at the piano, and then he wouldn't let me get up until I finished it. Waking streams of consciousness on a sleeping street of dreams, and thoughts like scattered leaves slowed in mid-fall into the stream. Fast running rivers of choice and chance, and time stops here on the Delta while they dance, while they seems dreamlike. In the daytime, and someone keeps thinking, in my sleep, about fast running rivers of choice and chance, and time stops here on the Delta while they dance, while they dance, yeah, while they dance, while they dance.
You know, I know you say Guinevere's maybe your best song, but that one's pretty close. That's a masterpiece. That's just a masterful song. That musically, that is just so gorgeous in the words. But I understand it was the last song you wrote for quite a while, isn't that true?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, hard drugs and creativity don't go together, no matter what anybody tells you. The more I did of coke and heroin, the less I wrote until I stopped writing completely. And then when I stopped doing that stuff, which is quite a while now, it's like 25 years ago. The writing came back. Came back in prison. I wrote Compass. Yeah. It was the first thing I liked that was actually pretty decent.
You know, it makes sense why songwriters would turn to substances, because like you said, you're writing a song, you're kind of reaching outside of your conscious mind. And at first, I'm sure it seems that certain drugs will help you get to that place. I mean, was it ever... did it ever help at first when you were doing certain drugs, or did it just get in the way?
I don't think so. No? I don't think pot and psychedelics get in the way of it.
No.
Not the way coke and heroin did, but coke and heroin definitely destroy it. They destroy creativity. There's no question at all about that. It's the truth. It's a tough truth for some people to get with, but it is the truth.
You've written two books, and you've detailed in explicit detail what you went through. And the things I got out of the book that were the most powerful, besides that it's a story of survival, that you survived it, was just how great friends Jackson Browne and Graham Nash were to you. I mean, there's so much love they had for you that they never gave up on you.
No. Particularly Graham. Graham's a really fine human being, so is Jackson. And they do take friendship very seriously, as do I.
Yeah. And though you said coke and heroin destroy creativity, it doesn't erase it completely, because it can come back if you get off that stuff. I mean, yours came back.
Yeah. It takes years, though. You have to get off it and stay off it for a while, and then you slowly start to wake up.
Yeah. Well, I've got handed many questions here. People want to ask you questions.
We have a side bet going.
We do.
About the questions.
We'll see if it happens. We'll see. We'll let you know. Having read Long Time Gone twice, I guess you mean the book, I was struck by two things. You should probably be dead. I thought you were going to filter these, actually. And each time you fell into trouble with the law or sank further into your addiction, lawyers and agents kept popping you up and, in effect, turn over. This is a long question. Allowed you to avoid actually getting help for your worsening problem until after many years you hit rock bottom. Let's start with a light question here. How do you feel about those folks propping you up for their financial benefit?
Yeah, that's a toughie, isn't it? There were people who did do that. At the time, I'm sure they thought they were doing the right thing, but they weren't. A person in that situation has got to hit bottom, and trying to put it off is just prolonging the agony. So
here's another question. Do artists overstep their bounds by having political views on stage?
The answer is no. There's more to it than that. It's a complex thing. Most of our job is to make you boogie, is to make you feel good, you know, to sing you, you know, love the one you're with, you know, something like that. Just to, you know, rock out and make you feel good. But part of our job for hundreds, if not thousands of years now, has been to be the troubadour, the guy who carries the news from one town to another. Obviously, they didn't have, you know, I mean, it wasn't until the 1500s that we even had any mass media at all, and that was Gutenberg and the printing press. And we didn't have any other ones for much longer than that, hundreds of years. And so it was our job. And we were also, you know, similar to the town crier. It's 11:30 and all's well, or it's 12 o'clock and we have a chimpanzee loose in the White House. Things aren't so good. He always kind of reminds me of a chimp. I don't know. Nuclear. It's so sad. I play in Europe a lot, and they, you know, we try to explain to them, you know, that we're from the other half of America, and they have compassion for us, but they still look at you like, how could you let him do that? It's tough.
It's surprising though when people think artists like yourself shouldn't express themselves in songs, because your songs have always been about who you are and what you believe in and what moves
and
you.
And sometimes political stuff is right in your face. Now,
Obama.
Let's talk about Obama. I love the guy. I love the guy. But that's neither here nor there. The where were we now before you did that?
How about that you're going to express yourself politically in art?
I think it's part of our job. And I think that we should be doing it. And I think that you have to be careful about how you do it. Because preaching isn't it. You should all go out and vote for blah, 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 blah. That's not it. We're not supposed to do that. But when you see, I watched Neil's face when he saw that picture of the girl kneeling over the kid on the ground in the pool of blood. And I watched him write Ohio.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like he thought it up. Mm. He saw something. It struck him in his heart. He wrote the song. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's a correct thing. It's okay when we do that. I think if you seek out causes, the causes of the week, you know, we arm the world, we arm the children. I have a lot of really massacred songs. The hills are alive with the sound of gunfire.
With Ohio, it was kind of remarkable that you made the record and you got it out immediately.
We got it out immediately. Yeah. I watched Neil write it, and I called Nash, and I said, Nash, get a studio now. Mm. Get it now. This minute. Go out, get a studio. I don't care which one. Get one now. We're on our way. And we went down and recorded it that night or the next night, I think. And Ahmet Erdogan, who was this wonderful old Turkish rug thief who ran Atlantic Records, he took the tapes to New York, and we had the song out in I think a week.
Kind of unheard of.
Tell you what kind of guy Nash is. We had Teach Your Children out and climbing the charts, and he took it off so that Ohio could go.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
It would have been a number one.
Wow, that's hard to believe. The thing, though, I mean. That song, Ohio, and Graham's song, Chicago, they reflected an American history. They were part of that history. They reflected the culture in a way that remains. And that's why you guys were special, because you were reflecting what was going on in the world, as opposed to the songwriters from previous generations who were writing songs for other singers. They were writing pop songs.
Well, not all of them.
Not all of them.
There's the guy we learned it all from, Pete Seeger.
Pete. I was meaning the Tin Pan Alley guys, but of course Pete.
Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie were, you know, our teachers.
Sure.
And that's where we learned it.
But I mean, as opposed to those Tin Pan Alley writers who needed to get a cut. But you guys knew your songs were going to be recorded, so you could write about subjects that other people wouldn't write about in previous
years. We didn't
even
really care if they were going to get recorded.
No?
We knew that we had to write the song.
But weren't you empowered by that knowledge that the song's going to go on a record?
Yes, but you got to remember, at that time, us sneaking a song like Ohio or For What It's Worth into the general music scene was like trying to slip, you know, smuggle diamonds in a stream of shit. The record company was saying, that doesn't mean what I think it does, does it? We say, oh, no. You know, it was more difficult, you know, getting it into the straight world. They really weren't ready for us to be singing the kinds of things we were. I remember the first time we dealt with that was when we wrote 8 Miles High. Mm. What's that about? Airplane, 40,000 feet in the air, that's 8 miles. That's where they fly, 40,000, yeah. 8 miles up, that's about the flight.
Well, speaking of that one you wrote with Gene Clark and with
Roger McGuinn,
yes, I was. And how did that come together? I understand Clark had some of the words, huh?
Clark, you know, was the guy who started that song, and he wrote most of it. We each wrote some. It was a wonderful song. I really loved it.
Yeah. The Byrds, to this day, are known as the inventors of folk rock. And in truth, you took mentioning Pete Seeger, you took Pete's very folky song, Turn, 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 and turned it into a rock song, and you did that with Dylan, with Mr. Tambourine Man. Was it a conscious thing that to combine those forms? How did that happen?
It was just what was natural to us. Much of the credit goes to Roger.
Oh.
He is an absolutely brilliant storyteller and a brilliant musician. And some of the credit goes to the guy who was our manager at the time, Jim Dixon. He said, you should do this song of Bob's. And I said, I hate the way he sings.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I was kind of jealous of Bob, you know. When he and I started out in the village at the same time, and I went to hear him at Max's, Kansas City, or Max's, I think, and someplace, Gertie's maybe, and I listened to him, and the audience was just going bonkers, and he was singing, you know, those songs, and I said, I got a better voice than he does. Why is everybody liking him so much? Okay, they're good words. So what? It was just me being a little overawed, I think, by Bob. It's pretty hard not to. He was writing incredible stuff.
When you did Mr. Tambourine Man, you did a shortened version. You took out some of his verses. Was that to make it more radio friendly?
Yeah.
Okay. I wanted to establish that. Okay.
Well, I mean, you know,
it worked.
It had like five verses or four verses, yeah, something. It would have been 7 minutes long.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. So. You know, a lot of people have said, great songwriters said it was Dylan that showed him that anything goes in a song, that there are no rules. You can write about anything. Did he have that effect on you?
Yes. Yeah. The guy's brilliant.
Yeah.
Unbelievable lyricist. He wrote about me one time.
Oh, yeah? Which song was that?
I think it's called The Locust.
Day of the Locust?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a great song.
Yeah, that guy, that man next to me with his head was exploding.
Yeah. That's you. More rock trivia that we didn't know. Fascinating. Wow. But it's interesting that you felt kind of awed by him, and that you ran into Joni Mitchell and Neil Young and all these other great writers who you befriended, but Dylan you kind of felt a competition with.
At first. After you really listen to his stuff, I wasn't in competition with him. I couldn't get even close to him. You know, I'll never be the writer he is. He was, you know, that was just me being a kid and wishing that I was as good, writing the songs as good as his.
Musically, it seems you have a bigger range than he does. You're more adventurous musically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you have to be good at something.
And that you are. And with the tunings on the guitar, David sometimes plays a normal tuning, but often he'll tune his guitars in different ways. Was that something you kind of invented early on? How did that happen?
You know, when you take one of these, it comes in this tuning here. And the first thing you do is you go, somebody shows you to take the bottom string, take it down to a D, and that's a drop D. It sounds really good. And you go playing with it. You think, wow, that's cool. And then one day you change another string.
Ooh.
And then change another one. And play a piece of music that I'm writing now.
Yeah.
I don't have words for it. Thank you.
I mean, are there certain tunings that you use often, or do you use many different ones?
Many of them. Wow. I have probably 10 that I use.
Joni does that. Did you two ever discuss different tunings? Or?
Yeah. Like I said, you know, I'd come play Guinevere, and then she'd trump my card. And she's... She and Michael Hedges, I think, were the two most advanced tuning players. Somebody knows Michael Hedges. Michael Hedges, yeah. Probably the greatest acoustic guitar player of our times.
Yeah. And he plays My Country Tis of Thee, right? He plays that track.
He was where I got it.
Yeah.
He's the one who did the arrangement. It's a guy that I really loved a great deal.
Would it be tough? How would you preserve a song like that? Did you just remember it, or would you tape yourself to capture those sort of songs?
What, that kind of thing?
Yeah, something like that. You can remember it, huh? It would seem hard to remember something like that.
It does after I smoke it. But
Stills told me that sometimes it's so hard to figure out your
chords. You got to watch out for that, man. The guy's a mine of misinformation.
I'm quoting him from you. I got some from Donald Rumsfeld here, too, but Stephen...
There's a conversation
later.
I'd love to hear. Stills and Rummy.
Yeah, the two of them, they spent
time.
Oh,
I remember when I was in Vietnam.
But he said there's some chords of yours that he just realized recently he's been playing wrong for like 13 years.
Rumsfeld told you that?
Yeah, Don said that. No, that's Stills.
Yes. Yeah. It took him about 20 years to learn woodenships.
Oh, okay. You know, after you did Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young...
It didn't slow him up any. He just didn't play the parts he didn't know.
Ah.
And he played great in the parts he did know.
Yeah, he's quite an excellent guitar player.
Yeah.
After Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young, you and Nash did an album. A lot of people call it the Black Album now. And it's just a miraculous album. It holds up so beautifully. All of your songs on that are great, but I love Page 43. It's one of my favorite songs. You know that one, Page 43? And, of course, a lot of people have thought, Page 43, you know, one guy said it's Page 43 of the New Testament, man.
You know, I've had people come to me with more wild guesses about what book Page 43 is in.
Uh-huh.
It's not. I had a guy, it's just endless. But, you know, you get those. There's a lot of nut butter out there in the world. I haven't sung this in a while. Let me see. Well, I won't work in that tuning, that's for sure.
He's a man who can tune his guitar by ear. No one does this anymore. We have tuners now.
Well, it's not that hard, there's harmonic points. To be says right here on page 43 that you should grab a hold of it, else you'll find it's past you by. Rainbows all around, can you find yourself some silver and gold? Gold will make you old. This river can be hot, it can be cold. You should dive right into it, else you'll find it's passed you by. pass it around one more time. Guess I'm going to have myself a swallow of wine. Life is fine, even with the ups and downs, and you should have a sip of it. Else you are going to find it's passed you by.
Yeah.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you. Great song. Song about diving into life.
Ask me something hard. Come on.
Okay. Well, I wanted to ask you, being a songwriter, you've written songs, you just start the first few notes of the guitar riff, and, you know, they bring back so much of our lives, and these songs have been the soundtrack of our lives. And they're such famous, beloved songs. They're not contrived. The radio audience is missing his shoveling mime right there. But the question is, as a songwriter, how does it feel to write songs like that? Because the songs are timeless.
It feels great.
Yeah?
It feels wonderful. That one's probably one of the most positive songs I ever wrote. And it's a joy, because you're taking something out of your insides and crystallizing it, making a pretty thing, a thing that you like. It's like carving a beautiful wooden spoon. You get to look at it when it's done and say, wow, I did that pretty well. That's okay. That's a nice thing, somebody be able to use it. It'll bring joy to somebody's life. And so you feel useful. You feel like you're contributing something. So it's a good thing.
And we live in an age now where you've made those records, and those records last. Your performances of them are preserved forever.
Unfortunately, yeah. So,
wow.
There are some that I'd rather would fade.
Really?
Yeah,
but you know,
most of them I'm pretty proud of. Hey, we got to go through all the cards to find out if I won the bet.
Well, I'm just interested in my own question. Okay, we'll go to this. I think there's another one. Please ask the doctor. Oh yeah, well, a doctor had emailed in saying, you know, you've been sober for a long time and you've dealt with sobriety. How did you accomplish that? Were you relying on spirituality or meditation?
No, I stayed sober for 14 and a half years. I smoke pot now. I don't smoke it much, but I do smoke it, and I like it. But I did stay straight for 14 and a half years. That was what needed to happen for me to get away from hard drugs. And they were killing me, so it was absolutely the right thing to do. And how I did get away from them was I went to prison for a year, which is a very tough way to kick. And then I went to 12-step meetings.
Oh, yeah?
Hundreds of them, over and over again, for years. Many, many years of going to meetings. And they work. What can I tell you?
You look great.
Thank you.
But being David Crosby at a 12-step meeting, didn't people give you, like, special treatment?
No. That's one of the things about 12-step. Doesn't do that. It's an equal opportunity employer, addiction and booze. You'll find that everybody is pretty much the same when they're down there groveling in the gutter, just drunk as a skunk. They're about the same as each other.
Here's a question from Kira Ward, 13 years. Thank you for putting your birth on that, 13 years old. If you became deaf tomorrow, what would the last song you would want to hear be? I never would have thought of that question. That's why we do this.
That's a toughie. Probably a Beatles song, something like Paperback Writer or, you know, some great Beatles tune that, you know, Day in the Life.
Day in the Life, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, I'm not absolutely certain, but I was there when they were recording that, and I think I'm the first person to hear it besides them.
Really?
Yeah.
But you're not sure you were there?
I'm sure I was there.
Are you?
And I was somewhat enhanced, and they did a funny thing to me. The Beatles are very funny guys. They had great sense of humor, and they were Well, they were somewhat enhanced also. And they had just finished this thing, and I showed up at the studio at Abbey Road, and they sat me down on a chair, a stool, in the middle of this huge studio, empty studio. And they rolled these... Abbey Road had these speakers that looked like coffins. They were giant things, and they were on end, on rollers. They rolled two of them up, you know. I remember, I think it was John going, pushing it up, acting like he was a gnome. And they pushed them up on either side of me, and then they went into the control room, and they were laughing. And I was sitting there, stoned out of my gourd, and they played Day in the Life. And by the time it got to the end of that last piano chord, I was just a dish rag.
Yeah.
I was a pile of noodles on the floor. It was quite an experience.
Did you smoke with the lads?
That would be their thing to tell you, not mine.
We'll get Paul McCartney here next month.
Yeah.
We'll ask him.
Yeah, and that was I shouldn't have told you guys that I smoked, but I decided I would be honest. So. Well, it was an honest question, I think I should give him the honest answer.
But James Taylor told me he was there when they recorded Revolution, and being a Beatles fan, I said, well, there's two versions. Which one? He said, I don't know, man. I can't remember that.
James is a hero of mine. James is about as good as it's ever going to get. He's just flat out terrific.
You said, actually, you wrote Page 43 under the musical influence of James.
Yes, I did. You know how he has all those beautiful passing chords and stuff? Well, I was trying to do that. I can't do it like he can, though.
He's like you. He's very humble, too. He says, I get too chordy sometimes. There's too many chords.
Yeah, there are people say that. I don't think James gets too anything. I just think he should keep on being as good as he is.
If you could write only one song, who would you dedicate it to?
Jan.
Russ Kunkel was CSNY drummer. Do you still work with him?
I do.
He comes here with Lyle Lovett. Thanks.
Yeah, he produced... Nash and I made a record 2 years ago now. Really, really... you forgive me for putting it this way, but a really good record. Thank you.
Awesome.
I thought so, too. And Russ will produce it.
Oh.
He played the drums on it and produced it.
Great drummer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So very good producer, too.
Have you ever shaved your mustache?
Not willingly. Not willingly. When I went in prison, they shaved it.
Oh.
Yeah.
I thought that was your
choice. Was a bummer. I do not have a great upper lip. However, that served me very well in prison, being old and fat and ugly. Was a good... Works pretty well for you there. Yeah.
And just how long did it take for it to come back to its full majesty?
Who, me?
Oh, the mustache.
Good evening, Your Majesty.
It's an important question.
It didn't take too long, you know. It grows back.
I'm hoping you remember an album called Blows Against the Empire, the only rock album to win a Hugo Award. You and Paul Kantner wrote a song called Have You Seen the Stars Tonight. Was that written at the moment or somewhat planned?
That was written at the moment. And it's one of my favorite things we ever wrote. I really love it. It's a great song. The thing about it is, I can't do it because I need Paul, but it's that thing about trying to write about something. You can't really say in a song, we lifted off at dawn and by the time we'd been in the air for 10 seconds, we were already out of the atmosphere, and there was Arcturus, and it just doesn't make it at all. Nah, it doesn't. So what you do is you write a song about somebody on the ship, and you focus on them, and you only get the fact that you're in space and going somewhere and that you can go anywhere in the universe sort of peripherally. You get it secondhand, listening to this guy trying to inveigle this pretty young other spaceship person to go up on A-deck and look at the stars with him. And I like that. I like being able to talk about big things by being able to talk about little things.
Mm. We've talked about how songwriting is an art and a craft, but your songs never have seemed overly crafted. They seem so organic and natural.
Well, it's different than it was when it started out. When I started out, I don't even have a handwritten set of lyrics for Almost Cut My Hair.
Oh, yeah?
There's never got written down. yeah, right. Nice. Drummer, count it up.
Yes, ma'am.
I'd love to play it for you. I like singing it, but it's a band song.
We don't mind.
Where the hell was I? You see, you totally distracted me. And now
you're talking about writing songs and not writing down the lyrics and how they're not overly crafted.
Once we got to the computer age, then I applied more craft to my songs. Oh. I'll write down, I write down everything because I didn't used to write it all down. And Joni said to me, David, you're an idiot. you say better things twice a day than most people ever write. You need to write it all down. If you get 3 words in a row that you like, write them down. So I started doing that. And then once computers came along, when you have a computer, you can, let's see, what if I take this part and put it here? Or what if it goes here? What if it comes out? And this one here comes up. You get to apply craft to the song more because of the computer. Musically too, because of Pro Tools, but that can be a very dangerous path.
Mm-hmm. Joni said that your eyes twinkled more than anyone's eyes ever did. They were like star sapphires. It was Joni Mitchell.
Yeah, well, she was in love at the time.
This song, this question, I think I know the answer. It's, what is your best song?
You know, that's difficult. That's kind of like saying, which one is your favorite child?
Yeah.
It changes. I think most people would say Guinevere.
Huh.
I don't know. There's a couple that I really like. I like Homer Through the Haze really a lot. I like some of the ones that I wrote with James on the CPR albums,
yeah,
which you probably, most of you haven't heard. But there are some, next time I'll bring James.
Yeah. And Jeff Pevar.
There are some songs in there that James and I wrote that I think are probably as good as Guinevere, if not better.
Guinevere surprised me when I was doing my homework that Stills isn't on it. It's on a CSN album, but it's just you and Graham. Why?
Well, Stephen writes very much in regular places, normal verse chorus kind of places and normal kind of chord relationships. He writes great songs. The guy is a great songwriter. But he writes very normal kind of stuff musically. Hmm. It's good and it swings. But Guinevere was just a complete, utter mystery to him.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's just like, what?
Really?
Huh? Yeah, basically.
But all your songs were complex in the same way. I mean, Deja Vu wasn't a simple song by any means.
Yeah, but he figured that one out.
Oh. So he couldn't find a part? That's why he wasn't on it?
Yeah. We'll go with that.
People conjecture why, how Guinevere got written. Some people said, it must have been psychedelics at the Renaissance Fair or something like that.
No, it was a love song. It's about 3 different women. And one of them was Christine, the one who got killed, and one of them was Johnny, and one of them nobody knows, and I'm going to keep it that way.
Is she the one with the green eyes?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. It's good to have some mystery left. Well, could we ask you to play Guinevere?
Well, I was going to end with that. Can we do that?
You ready? No, we don't want to end yet. We don't want to, man.
Well, let's go through the rest of the questions on the cards, at least.
I think we've covered most of them, but I'll pull out the cards again. Your best song?
What tracks? What's your
best? Oh, here's another one. Thank you. David, when is the next revolution with you and... I guess that means CN, the next, I can't quite make out this question. CSN, thank you, it said SNY. What is the next revolution with you and CSN?
CSN is a pretty live thing right now. We're going out this summer, and I think we're going to make another record.
All right. We would like that. Want to tell us anything about the record? Any ideas about
it? You know, I'd really love to. Especially, I'd love to tell you who's going to produce it, but I can't yet because it's a secret.
Could I get tickets for the show, maybe?
Yes.
Okay. I hope I do. You know, one thing I did want to ask you.
Ticket bastard.
Ticket bastard. He's having a private joke with himself here.
We hate Ticket Bastard.
Do you?
We hate him.
You know, when you guys came along, there was the Beatles and you and Dylan. Songwriting evolved in a big way. Suddenly you guys were writing for yourself, and there was poetry, and you were writing as a person. It was conversational, but it was poetic. And the music was new, and the songwriting evolved. And I kind of felt at the time, it's going to keep evolving, but it really didn't.
Yeah, it did.
That, did it?
Yeah, sure.
How so?
I mean, you look at the Birds, and then you look at Steely Dan.
Steely Dan.
That's evolution.
Yeah.
Steely Dan is probably my most favorite band next to the Beatles.
Yeah, I agree. They're tremendous, aren't they? Walter Becker has a brand new solo album called Circus Money coming out. It's very good.
I will be in line waiting to buy it.
Yeah. But do you feel it will continue to evolve? Is there a new place for
somebody
to go?
Yeah, absolutely. There are new people coming all the time, and some of them have political consciousness, too. A great many of them are of the young people now are only, you know, they're trying way too hard because they really are concerned with stardom rather than the music. But, you know, sometimes they come along and some of the young ones write really good stuff. I don't know if you know about this pop girl, Pink.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Did you ever hear her song, Dear Mr. President?
Yeah, it's good. Seriously good.
Shit.
Yeah, she's great.
Oh, I would have given a lot to have written that song. That girl is good. I discovered Janny and I discovered another group just the other day, listening to the radio. We were cruising along, and this guy started singing on the radio, and it was pretty much just one vocal and a guitar, and very heartfelt, and it was called I Will Follow You Into the Dark. And it's a group with the most awful name. And the name of the group is Death Cab for Cutie.
Oh, yeah. They're good.
And they're fucking good.
Yeah.
They write really good stuff, and they play and sing extremely well. They're very, very good. There are young people coming up. I mean, some of them don't make it. You know, if Hedges were alive today, he would be a star, I'm sure. I think he was for us. For the people that really listen, you know, that really love music, really deeply love music, you couldn't help but be affected by Michael Hedges. He was just... I ran into him in the oddest way. I was in a 7-Eleven on Miller Avenue in Mill Valley. And I came out of the place, and there was this kid sitting there in the door of his Volkswagen bus. And I walked over to him, and he said, "Hi, you're Crosby, aren't you?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "My name's Michael." He said, "Here, listen to this." And he played Aerial Boundaries. Mm-hmm. And I had to sit down. I sat down on the pavement. I didn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. My brain ran out my nose in a puddle. Look him up. Listen to Aerial Boundaries and tell me if your brain doesn't run out your nose. It's an amazing, amazing writer, player.
No, you were talking about Pro Tools and the technology of music, and the music business has changed so drastically since you started. I mean, I was showing my son, who's 8 years old, an LP the other day, and he'd never seen one. So these are so big. And to us, LPs were important.
Yes, sir, son. It's real cool. It's got a little piece of metal. It drops into a groove in the plastic.
Yeah.
And there's little teeny bumps down in there. And it bounces over the bumps, and it comes out and tells us what it was on the record. You never believe. Oh, come on, Pop.
Yeah.
And bumps.
And then you turn it over. He didn't realize he actually turned one over.
It's got something on the other side.
But now, I mean, there are CDs, of course, but now a lot of young people don't even ever buy CDs. They just download music from the
internet. I think that it's going to keep going that way.
Yeah.
I think iTunes is probably the record company of the future. And it's good with me. I'm an Apple guy anyway, so yeah. I love seeing them win, you know.
It changes, though, the dynamic of putting out a collection, putting out an album, if someone's just downloading single songs. Is that how
you
as an artist?
Yeah, it does. You think about the Beatles and what they did with Sgt. Pepper.
Yeah.
You can't do that. Can't do that.
Or Deja Vu or any of the stuff you did.
Yeah, but Sgt. Pepper was, if not a concept album, it was much more cohesive than anybody else's records had been up to that point. So
do you have hope for the music business that it'll continue to create good stuff and good music will happen?
You have to look at it this way. There's music, which is magic, and there's the business. Now, music has been mankind's magic since the beginning. The first caveman who danced around his fire going, hugga, bugga, hugga, bugga, he was boogieing. That was music. That was his party. Music has been mankind's party ever since we started. The business, on the other hand, is a horror show. I do not have good feelings about the music business, and I probably never will. And if you talk to any other musician, they'll tell you the same thing. The business pretty much sucks. But the music is worth it. And music will triumph again, man. What'll happen is some young flamenco band will lock themselves in a room with a bluegrass record or a jazz record or something, and they'll synthesize an entire new kind of music, and it will come out and sweep you off your feet. Mm. It's happened every time in the past, and it will happen again.
And yet you've thrived in the music business in a lot of ways. There have been a lot of artists who have been really chewed up and spit out, and don't have a
I kind of think I got chewed up and spit out.
Yeah, but you're still beloved. You're touring. Your records are very meaningful to us, and you have a career that is sustained.
But it nearly
whereas a lot of people don't.
But it nearly killed me.
Yeah. Oh, did it?
Yeah. The business did. Look, if you take a young guy with about as much experience as a flea and give him a couple million bucks and tell him, hey, have some fun, kid, he's going to get in trouble. Hit fast and deep.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure that the business did very well by me. But it did get the songs out there.
And yet, you remained an artist in the midst of it. You didn't start trying to write hit songs. You wrote David Crosby songs.
I have never written a hit in my life. I wouldn't know what one looked like. Well, we came close. I wrote a song with Phil Collins called Hero.
Yeah.
And that actually did get... Thank you. That actually did get played on the radio.
It did.
I was stunned.
He's somewhat of a hit maker, and it's probably one of the best things he's done, writing that song with you.
Well, it was fun.
Yeah.
It was a great deal of fun.
But was there ever pressure on you? Did anyone say, Dave, try to write something with a hook?
No, they knew.
Oh, yeah?
They knew it just wasn't going to happen for me. It could happen from a lot of other people. But
it's a challenge for all musicians to be an artist in a commercial world.
Yeah, to try and sell something at the same time that you're trying to make the best art you can. There are ways to do it, and it's much more difficult now. Some of it has to do with trying to be, different enough or shocking enough, to where people will, where it cuts through the fog, They'll turn down the TV. I don't know. I have still got hope for my music and how, because I keep hearing these young people come up who are terrific.
Yeah.
And because of the internet, they can make a demo and get it on there, and people will listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. That kid with the electric guitar who does Petchel Bell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
He's just a kid, but he put the camera down and he could really play. So now how many people have downloaded that off of YouTube?
Mm-hmm.
8,648,000 this week,
mm-hmm.
And that's a good thing. That's a good thing because nobody controls that. The record company doesn't control it. And even the government can't control it because the only way they can control the net is to shut all the phone systems down.
But can an artist
that part.
Can an artist have a career? Can he make a living?
I don't know. It's very tough.
Yeah.
It's very tough. Yeah. For instance, I don't make any money off of records at all anymore. I only make money doing live performance. That's the only way most of us make any money.
You get performance royalties when your songs get played, right?
Yeah, but in the old days, an album would sell 2 or 3 million copies.
Okay. I got a card here. Could you ask him to play a little of Triad? Would you mind playing a little of it?
Please.
Maybe if we all ask very nicely.
Let me see if I can remember it. It's been a long time. very early song.
Here's a good question. Hi, I'm drunk. That's a good one. Oh. What is your most meaningful song that you have written, would you say?
I don't know. I wouldn't be the one to judge that. You know. Meaningful, you know, it depends on what kind of meaning. I've written a lot of songs. I don't know. Somebody else would have to make that judgment.
Sure.
Well, Lee Shore's a good song.
I was thinking about the Lee Shore. You wrote it about the same time you wrote Triad, right? The Lee Shore?
Well, I like the Lee Shore. It's a good song because it's, you know, it's... You know, you got to remember, this is not a concert. All along the Lee Shore, shells lie scattered in the sand, winking up like shining eyes at me. From the sea, here is one like sunrise. It's older than you know. Still just lying there, where some careless wave forgot it long ago.
Beautiful. You've written many songs about the sea.
Yeah. Well, it's a big part of my life. Always has been.
You've been writing songs now for a long time. Does the process of songwriting ever get easier? Do you know more about it? Does that help? No?
No. It stays difficult, and I probably always will. And the hardest part is the words. You know, you can write words page after page, but you write words that actually make you feel something. Very, very difficult. I throw away a lot of words.
Do you?
Yeah.
Was that the case with most of your songs, that you would write more words and cut back?
Not at first.
Oh.
Not at first. Lately, more. Like I said, I've become a better editor with a computer.
Well, we've reached the end of all our questions. I want to thank all of you for coming up with great questions. I want to thank Lisa Consiglio, who makes this happen, and Daniel Shaw, and all the great people here at the Belly Up. And especially I want to thank our very dear guest, Mr. David Crosby. Thank you so much for doing this.
Forgot where the last verse went. Guinevere had golden hair. Guinevere had golden hair, like yours, my lady, like yours. Streaming out when we'd ride. Yesterday. circle endlessly, and I sing in silent harmony. We both shall be free. Thank you all. Paul Tallo.
Thank you.
David Crosby.
Thanks, Cross. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, everyone. Thanks for coming. I know I learned a lot, and I encourage you to read his book, Since Then, and to check out Paul Zollo's book, Songwriters on Songwriting. Check out our website, aspenwriters.org, because we do these not often, but several times a year, and I don't know that we'll ever be able to repeat what just happened, but I'm inspired to write, and I hope you are too. So whether it's a journal, whether it's a song, whether it's a poem, just go out there and be creative. And thank you again so very much. David Crosby, Paul Zollo. Thank you. Jan, Django, thank you so much for sharing your wonderful family member. And thank you so much, David, for sharing your incredible life. We'll see you next time, and let me know if you have any feedback. Thanks very much. Good night, everybody.